Welcome to the INSS podcast series. I'm Sarah Foyer. I'm a fellow here at the INSS, and I'm very happy to welcome today Dr. David Pollack. He's a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and the director of the FICRA Forum, an online blog in English and Arabic, featuring voices from the Middle East and bringing them into dialogue increasingly with Israel and also, of course, with Washington. David, thank you very much for being with us today.
Sure. So
the motivation for our conversation, I should tell our listeners, is a new edition of Strategic Assessment that has just been published, the INSS flagship journal. And you contributed a really interesting article to this volume. And so we're going to be talking a little bit about some of the wonderful nuggets in this article. You have been doing a lot of public opinion polling in the Arab world now for, I think, several decades, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes. Right. Right.
And in this article, you point to some very interesting trends in Arab public opinion. And so I want to ask you about them and then bring it back to a conversation about what all of this might mean for Israel moving forward. So one of the points that you raise in the article has to do with how Arab populations were now about a decade after the uprisings that people were called, of course, the Arab Spring. And you have found some interesting trends in how Arab populations are viewing the prospect of change. Are they more keen on stability? What are they prioritizing in terms of issues like economic sort of local issues versus broader ideas and even ideologies? So how do you see the sort of general landscape of Arab public opinion today?
Okay, great. Well, thanks for the opportunity. And I would say the first thing, maybe the single most important thing, is not to lump all the Arabs together. Every Arab society has its own unique profile of public opinion and its own unique circumstances. And so it's really, I think, a fundamental error to talk about Arab public opinion. Instead, we really need to talk about Egyptian or Jordanian or Sudanese or Moroccan or Gulf Arab public opinion, or even each Arab country separately. And in fact, to answer your question more directly, there are pretty big differences between or among different Arab countries, different Arab populations, and how they would respond precisely to your question about whether protests are good or not, whether democracy is a priority or not, whether stability or economic prosperity are more important than democracy, and so on. And I think what we're seeing today is that in countries that, generally speaking, in Arab countries that have undergone profound unrest, even civil war, as a result of mass uprisings in the first round of the Arab Spring a decade ago, that in those countries, many people, not everybody, but many people, if you ask them now, are protests good or not? Is democracy a top priority for you or not? Many people in those countries will say, no, it's not. You only get about 40% or so, for example, of Egyptians today saying that they think popular protests are a good idea, even against corruption, something which is almost universally despised and makes people very angry. But they're not so sure that after a decade of unrest followed by repression and great difficulties internally, they're not so sure that it would be a good idea to overthrow a regime or engage in massive protests on that issue or any other issue. And similarly, if you ask people in countries that are repressive, but politically, but stable and relatively reasonably well off economically, as is the case in the Gulf countries, for the most part, the Gulf Arab states, in the Emirates or in Saudi Arabia or Bahrain or others. And I've done polls in all six Arab Gulf states, except for Oman, in the last 5 years or 6 years or 7 years now, pretty consistently. What you will find is that people there, generally speaking, most people put democracy at the bottom of their list of priorities. And even though you get a significant number of people saying that protests are okay and that they would like to see the government do more to combat corruption, but they're not asking for revolution. They're not asking for elections. They're not asking for democracy as we tend to understand it in the West. They're asking for better governance, sure, less corruption, sure, but basically stability and prosperity are at the top of their list of priorities. And I will say one other thing about this before I anticipate what your next question is likely to be, which is that for most people in most of these countries, most of the time, the top priorities are not political at all. They're personal.
Right.
And they're not even religious. They're not, even though we tend to think of these as very conservative, traditional Muslim, religious, maybe even fundamentalist, I don't know, societies. That's not what most people say most of the time. If you ask them, what are your top priorities across the board? In this case, there isn't much difference from one country to another. People will say, my top priority is my job, my family, my income, my health. And it's not my religion or my politics or my country.
So I suspect that's pretty universal.
Yes.
So
yes.
I want to ask you actually, since you alluded to the Gulf countries, it's really a question about the monarchies. You know, you raised this issue in the article, this question of why it is that the monarchies, relative to most of the other states in the region, actually came out of the last decade in pretty good shape. Now, there are a lot of theories for why that is. I know what I found intriguing about your article is that you add another element to this, which is which is the issue of actually public opinion and how so explain that a little bit, tease that out. What is it that the monarchies are, what are they paying attention to when it comes to public opinion, if anything?
Right. Okay, so there are two sides to this. One is, as I see it, and as I think my surveys and I think the record, the actual record of the last several decades demonstrates, or at least strongly suggests, there are two sides. One is from the top down, the other is from the bottom up. So from the bottom up, people, in ordinary people in many of these countries do have a certain amount of respect or even affection for the monarchy and for the monarch. That institution and those personalities in many of these countries have a certain legitimacy at the popular level.
Yeah.
And it may be that, let's say, if you could do a totally honest sample of people's opinions about this, which you can't, but if you could, it may be that the monarch in some country or other, in Jordan or Morocco or Saudi Arabia or someplace, would get only a 30 or 40% approval rating. I don't really know, because you're not allowed to ask those questions.
Right.
Even I can't find a sneaky enough way to ask direct questions like that in those countries. But still, 30 or 40%, I'm guessing here, that's a significant chunk of the population that actually likes the king or likes the institution of a monarchy for various reasons. They may have some religious legitimacy, they may have some historical legitimacy, they may have some personal charisma. The people may feel that they're doing a pretty good job of keeping the country stable, which in many cases they actually are compared to other countries in the region, and so on and so on. So that's the bottom up. Okay, now from the top down, and this is what's maybe more surprising, the fact is that in many of these Arab monarchies, the palace itself, and I mean here the king personally and his most senior entourage, actually pay attention to public opinion. And they try to understand it, and even, at least to a certain extent, to cater to it, to accommodate it, right? To satisfy the public and to act to some extent, at least on some issues, in accordance with the public's wishes, or at least to find ways of pretending or convincing the population that the king and the monarchy have the people's best interests at heart. And this is not that well understood, but it's really important because what I've seen over many years is that in some of these monarchies, the palace actually hires pollsters to do private public opinion polls and find out what people are thinking and take that into account when they make decisions. A great example is Saudi Arabia, which is, yes, it's an absolute monarchy, and they don't publish any of the polls that they do, unlike me, right? I publish them all. But what I know, because I've been there personally, and I've talked to the pollsters who work there, and I've talked to the government institutions that do these internal public opinion polls, what I know is that when the king and his immediate entourage were deciding whether to let women drive cars or not, they did polls about it and to check how popular or unpopular that would be. And when they found out that it would be very popular and that there was only a minority of the population, the real diehard, you know, traditionalists who objected to it, that encouraged them to move forward in that direction. And now, obviously, they are not going to make every decision based on public opinion, but they're going to make some decisions based on public opinion and or based at least partly on public opinion, and that helps them to stay in power.
Right. So I'll it's fascinating, and I'll tell you why, at least I think from the standpoint of Israel, that this has some interesting implications. Because, first of all, as we all know, Israel signed a number of normalization agreements in the last year, and three of the four agreements were with monarchies, basically. So that's kind of just interesting for what it might suggest about the fact that these are the regimes that are, I suppose, stable enough to be entering into agreements. The other reason that it interests me has to do with public opinion, of course, about Israel in these countries. So talk a little bit about that. I mean, how do you see the sort of evolution in public opinion in some of these countries, taking into account what you said at the outset, that of course it can vary really from country to country, but when it comes to the ones, for example, that Israel has signed normalization agreements with, and then just more generally, where do you see public opinion coming down on issues having to do directly with Israel?
Okay, so a few points come to mind. One is, yes, it's true that three out of the four new countries, Sudan, Morocco, Bahrain, and the UAE, the Abraham Accords, three of them are monarchies. I think that's more of a coincidence than a kind of significant fact. But not entirely so. I mean, what the one advantage, if you want to call it that, that monarchies have, is that they can act in a kind of decisive authoritarian way if they choose to do so.
They don't have to deal with pesky things like parliaments or Congress, right?
Exactly, right. And so that makes it easier for them to actually go ahead and take a leap if they want to do that, if they choose to do that. Public opinion in these countries, generally speaking, has moved over the last, let's say, decade pretty clearly in favor of accepting the idea of having peace with Israel under certain conditions someday. And for example, on the question of a two-state solution, what you see is that you get a solid majority. And a two-state solution means peace with Israel. I mean, that's at least implied if there is also a Palestinian state.
Right.
So you get solid majorities in every Arab countries where I've been able to poll who say that that's a good idea, that they agree with that, they accept that. And this is not just a government decision or the so-called Arab Peace Initiative or something like that at the elite or at the official level. It has real popular acceptance as well. And that's a trend that has intensified in the last decade or so. Secondly, you even get more and more people in many of these countries, particularly in the Gulf Arab states, who say that it would be okay to have relations with Israel or peace with Israel, or it would be okay for some Arab governments, maybe not my government, but some Arab governments to have relations with Israel, even without a two-state solution, even before a two-state solution, right? Even without getting anything for the Palestinians. And depending on which poll you look at and when and in which country, you find really surprisingly high, maybe 60% acceptance of that idea in some of these Arab states, as I said, particularly in the Gulf, including in Saudi Arabia, to be very specific. Another thing to say about it is that what we can see is, and what I was able to see in my last series of polls, is that public opinion can change pretty quickly. It's pretty fluid or malleable, right? You can affect it from the top, or circumstances can change it pretty quickly. So I did some polls, for example, in the UAE in June. And
so this was, of course, this was before the Abraham Accords were signed, right? Okay.
Some polls and I did some polls there in June, and then in 2020, right? And then I did some follow-up polls in November after the Abraham Accords. And what I found was that, support in principle for the idea of someday having Arab-Israeli peace, that hadn't changed very much. That was pretty stable at around, something in the 40% range, something like that. Not a clear majority, but, pretty good, I would say. But what had changed by a remarkable, and I believe that these polls are really credible, by over 30 points in an upward direction, was the idea that it was okay on a personal level to have business or sports or other contacts with Israelis. Mm. Just between June and September of last year, in other words, before and after the official Abraham Accords were announced to the public, that number in the UAE jumped from only around 10% to something over 40% approval.
Amazing. It's as if they,
That public opinion in these countries, at least, or many of them, much of the time, works both ways. Again, it's both bottom up and top down. I want to say one last thing about this, if I have another 30 seconds of your time, which is that the exception to all of this, unfortunately, is Palestinian public opinion. And what we see there in the last decade is a steady decline in the percentage of the Palestinian public in both the West Bank and Gaza, and in East Jerusalem as well, who support a two-state solution and who support the idea of ultimate peace with Israel. So what you have today, at least, and again, it can change, and it has gone up and down in the past and probably will someday in the future. But for now, what you see is that many more Arabs in the surrounding region, a much higher percentage, are in principle supportive of the idea of peace with Israel and a two-state solution and everything that goes with it, than is the case among Israel's closest Arab neighbors, the Palestinians themselves.
Which I think at the very least is going to present some implications, if not challenges, for this idea.
Absolutely.
That getting Arab countries in the sort of periphery, shall we say, on board right. is going to have the effect that maybe the architects of some of these agreements had in mind in bringing the Palestinians and Israelis eventually closer together. But I'm going to have to leave it there for now. And thank you so much, right, David, sure. for chatting with us. And I sure. will just sort of tell our listeners that there is a lot more in this article. So I highly recommend going on our website, the INSS website, looking for the latest edition of Strategic Assessment and checking out David Pollack's article therein. There are a lot of other articles as well. Thank you so much for being with us, David.
My great pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Take care.
Bye. You bet.